Accession number 9423, Reel 6.
Mr. Plimmer, Reel 6. Did religion play any part in your life in the trenches?
As far as I was concerned, and everybody within my locality, religion was non-existent. I don't ever remember going to a church spread of any kind all the while I was in France. That was about a year. I don't think I ever went to a church spread. Even when I was out on a rest camp down on the coast, I didn't ever go to a religious spread. So I think religion was it was non-existent. I didn't know anything about it.
Were there any religious services provided for those?
I don't think so. I've never seen anybody. If there had been, we would have been on them. But I don't ever remember going to any, even when we were out on rest. No. There were padres about. Padres used to come round the line occasionally.
Did you ever talk to one? Did one ever talk to you?
They came and talked to us. Yeah, they come and talk to us.
What did they talk about?
How are you getting on? Are you keeping well? And are you getting letters from home and all that sort of thing? Usual guff, that sort of thing.
Were you a religious person before you went into the trenches?
No, I dare say they had religious dues in these canteens, you know, but I've never been to any of them. No, I wasn't a religious man. I was more of a billion saloon hawker.
A more of a what?
A billion saloon haunter.
I see. What do you mean by that?
I want in billiard saloons. Well, you know, going out with the lads and all that sort of thing. But church, I never went to church.
Okay, thank you.
Don't go now, as a matter of fact.
I'd like now to move on to the provisions for rest periods that you received when you were in the line. Can you tell me how often rest periods came around?
Well, the accepted situation was that inside a month you did 3 weeks in the line and another 1 week out on rest. And when you went out on rest, you went out to a little place where our battalion was situated. It was a place called Fosse 2. It lay behind Le Breby. It was about 7 or 8 miles from the front line. And we'd spend a week there in disused houses and sleep on the floor, have meals regularly, do a little bit of work, loll about all day. That's where we saw those people who were being field punished, you know. Not only us, but other people. But our little area was in this Fosse 2. That's what we do.
This is when you were in the Loos sector?
And that was when we was in the Loos sector. We'd just hang around. It was a rest, it was. But occasionally, you might be unfortunate, and your rest period might consist of going up the line at night time, doing work. I've been involved in that situation when I've been gone out of the line on a week's rest, and at night time you've had to go up the line and carry up stuff, works, dig trenches and all that sort of thing.
Can you tell me which ones you were particularly involved in, which duties you particularly were asked to do?
We used to be out on rest, and if there was no work to be done, you'd have a complete rest. But you may be in an area or a period where there'd been a lot of damage done and it's got to be repaired, and it was beyond the scope of the people in the line. Well, people who were out on rest would have to come up and do it, you see. They may decide to dig an extra trench somewhere or something like that. I was at Loos, and at Loos there was a big slag heap. Probably heard about it. Big slag heap. We once dug a communication trench right across the top of that so that people could move from one side to the other without being observed by the enemy. That sort of thing. You might probably go up about 10 o'clock and work about 5 or 6 hours and come back and sleep all day.
How many nights did it take to do that communication trench?
Well, I don't know how long, but I think on the time I was in that, we were up every night.
The whole night of your rest period?
Yeah, every night of the rest period.
How did you feel about that?
Pretty lousy. Yeah.
Can you remember any other duties you did whilst you were on rest?
No, we just lolled about. We were actually on rest. We rested. Just probably played football or something like that.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about what recreation you enjoyed whilst you were there.
Well, when out on rest there was probably a canteen out there where we could go and play darts. I don't remember any billiards. But there were football. We used to play football, about 20 a side or something like that, you know. If you'd had two kicks of the ball, you'd had a good game sort of thing, you know. All that sort of thing, you know.
Were any gambling games?
Oh, gambling. Good Lord. People were gambling night, day, all day long gambling. Oh, that was a very profound recreation, that. I wasn't much good at that myself.
What sort of gambling games did they play?
We used to play a crown and anchor.
Can you explain that to me?
Well, a crown and anchor is a game in which they have a sheet divided into six squares. One square's got a crown on it, known as the sergeant major. Another one's got an anchor on it, known as the mud hook. And the other four spaces are filled up by the hearts, clubs, spades and diamonds, you see. And then the fellow has a couple of dice, you see, and he throws these dice, and whatever comes up, he pays out accordingly, you see. He can beat you at all. He's 3-1 all the time. He always wins. People put... I've seen, when I was down at the base once, I've seen overseas still put piles of money on it. I'll tell you about that later.
Well, perhaps you could tell me about it now.
Well, once upon a time, when just before the big push started in August, I went down to Boulogne for a fortnight's rest. Not Boulogne, but a place called Ordre Cells near Wimmera, big camp, great big camp, near Cape Grisnay, you know, where we used to go in the sea every day and loll about and have a real good time. And the Canadians and Australians there used to gamble terrific amounts of money. I used to stand and watch them, more money than I'd ever seen, never mind own. They used to put on these crown and anchor boards, and there used to be great big schools of it, you know. And all the people who had these crown and anchor boards, they'd all the patter off, you know. And they used to play a lot of housey, which is known as bingo now, a lot of that. There was a great deal of patter went on. I used to play bingo with them, house, you know, but very, very rarely involved in...
Was that done for money as well?
Well, you pay for a card, and if you fill your card up first, you win the prize. But I was never involved in these big gambling, never had the money to do it, nor the inclination for that matter.
Did the gambling cause disputes at all?
Oh, I wouldn't be a bit surprised, yeah.
Did you see any instances of that yourself?
Never seen any, but there must have been. Must have been.
You mentioned the Australians and Canadians putting large amounts of money on such gambling games. What did the British soldiers, when they were in rest, what sort of bets did they put on?
We were very, very envious of them, because they used to get more paid than we did. Well, they put down what they'd got. When we went down on rest, I think the period when I went down, we'd had no pay for months. There was no need for any pay, so you had a great deal of credit. Then when you went down onto this holiday, you got a lump sum. Not all of it, you know. You'd probably get 300 or 400 francs. I mean, francs were about 20 to a quid then. You'd have a fair amount of money. Well, I mean, people gamble with it. I didn't gamble with it. I just spent it on other things. Cake and tea and chocolate and eggs and chips and that sort of thing. But there you see, people who've got gambling instincts, they go straight at it and lose all their money right away in these big schools.
If we could return to the rest periods when you were actually serving at the front.
Yeah.
Can you remember any other games that people played?
No, we used to have to make our own amusements. When we went out to from the line after being 3 weeks in the line, and we were going for a supposed 1 week's rest, we used to occupy these houses that they were miners' houses, all coal mines around there, and we just used to live there and do nothing at all and go for our meals. Mm-hmm. Unless you were unlucky enough to be involved in some night operations, they did nothing at all. There was nothing to do. It was just rest. I can recall at the period we were there, it was beautiful sunny weather, and we just used to lie out on the ground. I think I remember now that somebody had started a bit of a garden, vegetable garden. I don't know. Some people used to muck around with that, but the remainder just did nothing at all. Just rested. Either rested in your billet or did anything like that. Perhaps clean your kit up or something like that. Saw all your buttons on, but we had no recreational. But down at at Boulogne, you know, they used to have organised there. They had these big concert parties. Lena Ashwell and all those kind of people used to have regular concerts two or three nights a week. Well, every night, but in different parts of the camp, they had these big concerts where these ENSA people, who were eventually ENSA people, used to come out and give shows.
Could you describe one of those shows?
Big band?
Did you go and see one of those shows?
Oh, you could go in. They were all open. You just went into the big marquee when they went on. And
did it cost you any money to get in?
Nothing at all, no. They'd just say, well, there's a big concert here tonight, 7 o'clock, and when it was full, it was full. You'd go off to another one, find another place where there wasn't one.
Could you describe what one of those concerts consisted of? What sort of entertainments there were?
There'd be a soprano singing Shalimar, Rose of Shalimar, and some comedian telling a couple of jokes that he don't tell in other places, like, you know. Oh, singing, and then they'd have a bit of community singing.
What sort of songs would you sing then?
Oh, Tipperary, and Pack Up Your Troubles, and all that sort of long, long trail, and winding, and all that sort of thing, you know. Just to keep the troops' spirits up, you know. But they had these people who come out from England, although some of them were resident. I think Lena Ashwell was a resident there, as far as I can understand.
Can you remember the names of any other performers you saw?
No, I can't, honestly, no. But they were people who came out. They may be second-rate people and eventually became stars, but I don't know who they were. And yeah, we were there for a fortnight, two weeks down there. Very good. We used to go swimming in the sea.
Could you tell me something of the reaction of the British troops to the French civilians?
None at all, because I never had any contact with them at all. Even when we was down in Saint-Valery, and at order cells, we very, very seldom came in contact with them. Couldn't speak French at all, and I couldn't speak a word of it. Can't speak much of it now, but I couldn't speak anything of it then. No.
Did you ever come across any of them at all?
Well, when we was down in Saint-Valery, we used to have to go in shops and buy our eggs and chips, but that's about all we could see. We didn't have to ask in French. They could speak English pretty well, most of them. But when I was down at Ambleteuse, Ordersells and Ambleteuse, I never met any of them. All English people there, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think there were many French allowed in the camps, as far as I can tell you.
Did any of the English troops fraternise with the French?
Pick up
French girlfriends, things like that?
They did do, aye.
Did you know of any instances of that occurring?
Not really. The only time that the people who I knew would have any fraternisation would when they would be down at the camp, at the coast. I never went out much.
Why not?
Well, I was quite content to stop in the camp. As a matter of fact, it was a long walk into Wimereux, and it was an even longer walk into Boulogne, too. And I never bothered to go down there.
Okay. I think you've mentioned at some point receiving parcels of food from home. What other things did you get from home when you were off?
What, parcels, you mean?
Yes, you've already mentioned parcels. What other things did you get from home?
Well, the only thing that one got from home came in a parcel. It could be socks or a scarf or a pair of gloves or some medication, food, that's all.
You say some medication, what sort of things were that?
Well, they might send you some throat pastilles or some Condy's fluid or some ointment, any sort of thing. Not for me, but generally speaking, we used to have, when we was at, this was when we were in, when we came out of the line on rest once, we used to get our mail, you can record us if you like, we used to get our mail in every day, and we used to go to a sort of a barn place, where there was mangers, you know, and all the mail would be in there, and the corporal, I remember him very well, Cockney bloke, a right lad he was, he used to be in charge of the mail, and we twigged this, we got into this thing. When the parcels came, and the parcel was for somebody who was dead or killed, he just chuck it over the manger, you know, over the side. We used to catch it and walk off with it. Many and many times we walked away with the packet of fags that's been destined for somebody who's been not there. Of course, this bloke used to keep these, but we got wise to him. And, you know, hijacked his tackle.
Yeah. Did that happen whilst you were on rest from the front?
Yes. Oh, yes. Mm. When we was down at Foss too, places like that, you know. Mm.
Can you tell me about receiving letters from home or writing letters to home?
Oh, we could write letters whenever we got the opportunity. People were writing them all day long. But, of course, they had to be censored. They used to have this censorship. If you put them into a plain open letter, open envelope, they had to be left open, you see, and the officer were in your position would censor them. But if you didn't want him to censor them, they used to use these things called green envelopes. They weren't green. They had green facings, and they would be censored at the base. I think we used to get issued with two or three of those a month. But we also had these little cards where we crossed out the we are and we aren't sort of thing, you know. But mail, we used to get mail regularly.
Can I just stay with these different envelopes, though? When you were actually writing home, which ones did you use the most?
Well, when I was writing to my girlfriend, I used the green ones. And when I was writing to my parents, I used a white one. That's the sort of thing.
Did you resent the officer that censoring
your
mail?
Well, you weren't allowed to say where you were. I mean, you couldn't write them and say, "Dear Mother, I am now at Lewes." That would be crossed out immediately. Or if you tried to introduce any kind of a code that would give them any inclination, the officers would try and spot that and they'd wipe it out. But you could put that in if you wanted to, but it would be crossed out. The officer might not look at it, you know. You take a chance. But if you wanted to write something personal, you'd use these green envelopes, and then the people down the base would deal with them. They might not bother, I don't know, but that's what they did. They crossed that, what they didn't want people to read.
Why would you use a green envelope rather than just an open envelope? Because they're both going to be censored.
You could put some personal matters in a green envelope, couldn't you? You know, people might want to say something personal. They might want to tell a girlfriend that they loved them or something like that, whereas they wouldn't like the officer in their section to know that they were so far involved with anybody. That sort of thing. It was for privacy, you know.
Did you ever have leave in the United Kingdom during the war?
Not during the war. I went on leave around about Christmas 1918, but not during the hostilities.
No. How long would you have to fight before you were allowed to go back to the United Kingdom?
Well, there was a specified period designated, but I can't remember what it was. I think you were entitled to so much after so many months, after about 6 months, but I don't know. Maybe 4 months, maybe in half a year, I don't know. But there was a roster kept, and people went on leave according to the time they'd been out there, the position on the roster. I've known people going home on leave from Blues, but then they'd been out there some time.
Did you envy them going back to the United Kingdom?
Oh, indeed, yes. But they always seemed to be back before they'd gone, you know. Yeah.
Did they bring any news from home? And
oh, yes, they used to come back and bring things back, you know. They always have a shopping list, razor blades and so that sort of thing they'd bring back for you.
What other things would you ask that you could for that you couldn't get in the line?
Well, it's like, as I say, razor blades, shaving extra stuff like that. Perhaps a bloke want a mirror he couldn't get or something like that. Couldn't get everything in the canteen. Oh, well, I mean, you could occasionally, but you might be there when they'd got none, you see, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the one other thing that I don't think we've mentioned, apart from in passing, when we're talking about the rest periods, was the canteens that existed there. Could you describe them to me?
Well, they were great big marquees with a counter at one end, and an unlimited supply of goodies behind the counter. Then there was tables and chairs where one could sit down. You could buy tea and get biscuits and sandwiches. And in some parts, you could get a meal, but not always.
Who were these canteens run by?
Oh, they were run by the Naffy.
Are you describing a canteen, the sort that would exist at Foss 2, or the one that was in Blois?
Oh, there was the same sort of thing up there, yes. At Foss 2, there would be canteens, something similar, where you could just get tea and boot polish and shaving stuff and all that sort of, not elaborate. They were big. You could get tin fruit and all that sort of thing there. As a matter of fact, when the Germans broke through in March 1918, that was one of the first things they made for our canteens, which were well stocked with tin fruit and chocolates and cigarettes and all that sort of thing. You could buy anything that was available. They were good supply and things like that.
Was there any entertainments laid on at places like that at all?
Anywhere?
Any entertainments laid on?
No, there was no entertainment laid on at Foss 2, no. Well, that was with an easy distance of the line. I mean, you could be, we used to go up at night time and dark. That was nothing there. We used to have to make our own entertainment or do nothing at all. It was indeed a rest, unless you got mixed up in some fatigue at night time. Mm-hmm. We didn't always get mixed up there, but the infantry, I think, did a lot of it.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you remember how long you stayed in the Loos sector before you actually moved down from the line?
Well, we came back to from March. That would be sometime in April. We had about a month or 6 weeks down St. Valery. Then we went up to Loos. So we've been Loos about June. And I went, and then I went, then when we were up there, I went on this holiday down to Audra Cells. And when I was away, my battalion were on the move to go into the big attack. And I picked them up at a place called Souchay, I think it was, where they entrained for the Hindenburg line.
I see. Can you explain whilst it was that you went on holiday down to...
Well, it was my turn, see. I was out, I was in the line, and I was my turn to go on a holiday, you see. And they just took me out of the line and went down to Foster and got on a lorry next morning, and away I went.
Did you go with members of your company?
Oh, yes, several more people, a lorry load of people. Not all from my unit, but from, you know, the infantry and various parts. Yes, it was my turn. My number came up, you see. That was, and it was while we was there that the big offensive started, and when I finished my time down there, I went up, and they were on the move, see.
I see. And where did you say you went up to?
Well, I don't quite know the name of the place where we entrained, but it was around about Lens Way, somewhere like that. And then we went by train across the old Somme battlefields, and then we got off the train at a place called Markowing, and then we were in the battle then, right into the Hindenburg line affair then.
Was Markowing near any major town?
Yes, it was near Cambria. Now, when we got to Markowing, the offensive had been in operation some time, and the Hindenburg line lay in front of Cambria, and it had already been taken when we got there. So when we crossed it, we crossed at a place called, I don't know the name of the place, it was the Canal du Nord, which was being built. The canal was there, there was no water in it, and we just went down one side, walked across the bottom and up the other side, and then we were actually mixed up in a battle.
Was there much signs of battle as you moved up towards?
We moved up to the battle from the Hindenburg line.
What was the terrain like that you were crossing?
Well, pretty flat. Well, there was a canal being dug. There was no mountains or anything like that. See, this Canal du Nord, as far as I can recollect, formed part of the Hindenburg line. And when we got it, it was a great big ditch, you know, like a dry dock stuck in the ground. And we just went down the steps on one side, walked across and up the other. It had already been taken when we got there.
Yeah, was the country very much damaged by the battle that had taken place?
It wasn't damaged much at all. Didn't seem to be, no. Whatever damage had been done, the REs had put square so that we could go on. Mm-hmm. And then when we got across this canal, you know, we were part of the battle then.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I ask you, in fact, sort of briefing you were given before you took part in this battle? What things were you told to do?
Well, as far as I can recollect, I'm only talking from memory, I think the idea was that one set of troops would go forward early in the morning to attain an objective, and when they got there, they would stop there, and then another lot of troops would leapfrog them and go on, and the people like who went to the first would stay there until it was their turn to go forward to leapfrog. They wouldn't be in the battle day after day after day. They might start off on Monday morning and attain their objective on Monday night and stay there, and then probably then march up about Tuesday or Wednesday and join in the battle, and that sort of thing took place. They weren't advancing in one straight line without any help or any aid or any rest. You see, we had a lot of troops behind us.
Yes, what role were you expected to play?
Well, we would say, well, we've got to go and take that... We knew we had to take that village and we'd go forward. The infantry would be in front of us and the tanks would probably be in front of us, and we would come along behind. And when the infantry got there, the machine gunners would set up a defensive post and they would be there to defend that place. not really to attack it. We didn't actually be involved in the attack. We were more involved in the defensive when we got there, you see. Although when we were going in the attack, we would be engaged with the enemy. Like we'd run across them, and we wouldn't just sit down and say, oh, we don't start till 5 o'clock or anything like that. But when the infantry had attained their objective, we would be in the role of...
Can you remember how you were told what to do?
Well,
who told you?
Officer would come along, a sergeant major. We know what we were doing.
And who would he tell within the machine gun company?
Well, in a machine gun company, there was four sections with four guns each, so there were 16 guns in the company. Well, your section would be working in a particular area. You wouldn't know what the other people were doing. You know probably that they were going to go for the same thing as you and support you, and you would support them. But as far as people out on the right, you wouldn't be aware. You'd have an idea. But you would say, look, there's a village there called Jones. We've got to capture that. And the infantry would go forward and capture with the tanks, you see. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, we would consolidate it. Mm-hmm. The infantry would be there as well to consolidate it. They wouldn't go back and say, oh, we've done our job, it's sure now. Mm-hmm. They would be there. But we would join in with them and dig machine gun posts and find out the best place to be to defend it and all that sort of thing. And then sometimes the Germans would counterattack and we'd have to beat them up. That's happened. Mm.
Do you recall making any special preparations for this operation that you're going to be involved in?
Well, all I can recall is that my unit would march up to an assembly point. I wouldn't know anything at all about that. But when I got to the assembly point, somebody would come down and tell us what we'd got to do, what we were expected to do, and we'd get on with it when the time came. We wouldn't go forward on our own. We would go forward, the whole division would go forward, the whole brigade would go forward. We would be told, not in detail, not minutely, but we know what our objective we'd got to be. We'd got to go to this particular place and follow the infantry up and form a defensive line when the infantry had taken this line, and they would just move off. We walked along roads. At this time, you know, the enemy were going back that fast that it was sometimes difficult to catch up with them. At other times, they would stand still and you'd have a job to move them. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, we would march along the roads with all our limbers, your horses and limbers, and all the artillery would march along the road until they come to a point when they couldn't go any farther, and we would have to dismantle our stuff off the limbers and carry them forward right into the area where our objective lay. But generally speaking, it was simply a case of walking forward and occupying this place, mostly without opposition, but not always. There was always shelling going on. You'd get caught in shell fire, long range, big stuff, by the way, because their guns were well back. And that was the way they went on.
Yes, I was referring to sort of personal preparations yourself before you actually went into battle.
None whatsoever. No. We didn't do anything at all. We'd have our breakfast, whatever it was, make sure you'd made your will, sort of thing.
Can you think of any other things that you did beforehand? Who did you hand the will to?
Big pardon?
Who did you hand the will to?
You didn't have a will. Well, I'm only saying that you could make the will in your pay book. That was only an afterthought, you know. People could make the will if they thought they were going into action.
Did you do that yourself?
No, I didn't bother with it at all. I had nothing to leave anybody. But in a man's pay book, there was provision for making a will, a valid will, too. That's people could do that if they were going into action for the first time or they wanted to. But otherwise, no.